You are listening to Disrupt Development, the podcast that shares inspiring stories of disruptive thinkers and doers within sustainable development. Drawing on 2 decades covering global development as the founding president and editor-in-chief of DAVEX, in this podcast, Raj Kumar and I will explore how development aid is going through disruptive changes, what old aid versus new aid looks like, the need to move from a project focus to a business mindset, how billionaires, tech disruptors, and social entrepreneurs are transforming global aid industry, and what we can learn from them, the importance of decolonizing aid, and much more global trends influencing your future work.
But development isn't really about projects. It's much more about people. And people don't fit neatly into a project always. And often what we're looking for is systemic solutions, not a project that ends and then all the work that was done kind of disappears. So I think increasingly in the new aid world, we're thinking about how to get beyond that project mindset.
Raj Kumar is the founding president and editor-in-chief at DAVEX, the media platform for the global development community. He is a media leader and former Humanitarian Council Chair for the World Economic Forum and a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. His work has led him to more than 50 countries, where he has had the honor to meet many of the aid workers and development professionals who make up the DAVEX community. He is also the author of the book The Business of Changing the World, a go-to primer on the ideas, people and technology disrupting the current aid industry. Raj, I'm thrilled to have you on the Disrupt Development podcast. DAVEX has been always a very important go-to source for myself as being a development professional. Also, I have been following some of your recently launched podcasts where you interview other development professionals. All very interesting. And therefore, I'm also very happy that this interview, I will be asking you the questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. Really excited to get to do this with you. And it's really a pleasure to be with all of your community there with Partos. Nice to virtually at least get a chance to visit the Netherlands.
Thanks and feel welcome. So Raj, you have founded DAVEX in 2000, almost 20 years ago, as a graduate student at the Harvard Kennedy School. In what way has DAVEX disrupted the international aid system? And how does DAVEX still tries to be innovative?
Yeah, we've tried to disrupt the space in a couple of ways. One is by democratizing who gets to be in the global development community. So, you know, one of the really valid critiques of our field is it's a bit like a closed club. And in fact, when I was at the Kennedy School as a graduate student, I wanted to get a job in development. And I would ask people how to do that. And they said, go down to Washington, D.C. and attend cocktail parties. And this is how you get a job. You network. And I thought, is this really how a mission-driven field of nonprofits and government aid agencies, this is how it works? But they were right. This is really how it works. And so we thought by creating DAVEX, we could make a neutral platform where anyone, no matter where you're sitting in the world, can publish your resume and say, hey, I want to get a job working on an aid project in my own community, or, you know, look at job opportunities or read about projects or even just research the NGOs and other organizations doing work. And so we've tried to disrupt the field by, first of all, just making it more transparent and open by democratizing it. And I think, and we have lots of anecdotes and even survey results that suggest that we've helped organizations that otherwise couldn't get funding to get access to it, individuals that otherwise couldn't get a job in our field to get access. I remember one engineer from South Africa telling me that she had never been able to get a job on a development project in her own country until she accessed our website, which is based in the United States, which is kind of crazy, but it just shows you how the field was really restricted. And then the second big way we've tried to disrupt this is by just doing journalism, traditional journalism, you know, asking tough questions. Our field is one dominated by communications agencies and communications departments, and there's a lot of good value in that. But you also need journalists to not just be giving you the positive story, but to tell you what's really happening. Sometimes it's very positive, but sometimes it's not. And that's something we've tried to do at DAVEX is to tell those stories and to do that in a really objective way with real context. And I think that has helped to disrupt our field quite a bit.
And how has it changed over the years?
You know, I think development has become a more open space. So it's less of a closed club than it used to be. It's a more global field. This used to be a field where if you wanted to work in the United States, you would work with USAID and maybe a little bit with the World Bank. And that was it. That was your whole universe, was a small cluster around Foggy Bottom in Washington, D.C. And now really it's a global field. And the competition is global between NGOs and aid organizations, competition for results, the competition for funding, for talent. So it really has globalized quite a bit. And I think there's what I argue in my book is there's more of a revolution toward results. There's more of a drive toward actually achieving real results than there ever were before. And I think DevEx has been a small part of that. I think it's a much broader trend than us. But I do think there's a big trend that I would like to see furthered personally, and that's toward moving away from good intentions as the main animating focus of our work and saying, yes, of course we need to have good intentions, but let's also have real accountability for results. Yeah. What are we actually achieving? And if when we don't do that, we get all of the horror stories of failed projects and even harm that gets done in the name of doing good. So we need to have the good intentions, yes, but we have to have a real focus on the results. And I think that results revolution is happening.
Yeah. So that's one of the trends basically you describe in your book. The book you're talking about is The Business of Changing the World, where you also talk about old versus the new aid. Very interesting to read. I would definitely recommend everybody to buy the book, otherwise to borrow it from myself. So let's try to unpack these concepts. What are some of the major challenges old aid brings along? So let's first focus on old aid, some of the systemic, basically, challenges we are currently experiencing or have been experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, we have people marching in the streets in the United States and around the world on structural racism, right? And increasingly in our field, we're talking about decolonizing development. And it's just worth remembering, yes, the field we're in, we've done a lot of good work. There's been tremendous achievement, especially on things like global health. But the very structure of the aid industry is based on some antiquated ideas. It is based on a colonial era, right? So you have certain countries which are quite rich and others which are quite poor, and that's not an accident, right? That is a result of a specific history. And so these quite rich countries have set up organizations and agencies and funds to support the poor countries and the poorer people. That's a good thing. But what comes with that is a lot of these traditional structures where aid can be very top-down. Decisions can be made in rich country capitals that affect people in poor rural areas in the global south, or as we say, the developing world often. We can be a system and a structure where, you know, if you're an American, if you're a European, it's easier to start that NGO or to get access to funding or to get the job, even though the more effective thing might be for the funding and the decision-making and the work to be happening locally. Yeah. So those are some of the reasons that I think old aid has been less effective than it could be. And then another one is the fact that most of that aid in the old world has been from government, which can be a good thing in many ways, right? It's taxpayers supporting values and principles, but government spending tends to happen through government procurement. And what governments are comfortable with in their procurement tends to be projects. So we get very focused on very specific timelines and milestones and a project orientation. But development isn't really about projects. It's much more about people. And people don't fit neatly into a project always. And often what we're looking for is systemic solutions, not a project that ends and then all the work that was done kind of disappears. So I think increasingly in the new aid world, we're thinking about how to get beyond that project mindset.
Yeah. I think this is very interesting. In one of my podcasts with the de facto leader of the global shift to power movement, Jenny Hudson, she was talking about the same, that development aid is predominantly focused on projects. And actually we're talking about the lives of people and creating a sustainable change. So how can we work towards more sustainable projects, basically, and sustainable solutions? And that requires a systemic change. In one of your online seminars, you also describe that aid is already moving from the project model to business model. And I think that also relates to business model focusing more on sustainability, self-sustaining aspects of the work we are doing, basically, right? Could you perhaps explain this?
Yeah, and I think there's an important distinction to make, because when I talk about using market mechanisms, oftentimes people hear that and think, oh, that must be kind of a pro-capitalist, business-oriented way of development, but we want to focus on nonprofit, or we want to focus on our mission. And I don't mean that in an ideological way. I'm talking about market mechanisms as tools. It can still be done in a nonprofit way. It can still be done even in a government way, but using the tools of markets to help make change that's sustainable. And of course, there are many examples now of social enterprises, a lot of them started by nonprofit organizations that can do this, whether you're providing water service and having people pay for it, or you're providing, as I tell in the book, the story of Hello Tractor, which is like an Uber for tractors. Started in Nigeria, and now they're in 5 countries in the continent of Africa. 75% of the new tractors in Nigeria are equipped with this Hello Tractor technology, where you can share your tractor in an Uber-like platform. And there's a lot of opportunities when you think in these market terms. And the main distinction about a market mechanism from more of a project mechanism is who is the customer. And in a project, the customer might be, in the case of Partos and your members, it might actually ultimately be the Dutch government, Dutch Foreign Affairs Ministry. They're the ones funding it, and they've created certain requirements. You have to meet them. So is that client happy? Is that customer happy? Versus when you build a market mechanism, your customer might be, in the case of Hello Tractor, a subsistence level farmer, a relatively poor person earning a few dollars a day. That's your customer. And you live or die whether that person is finding your service useful and it's helping her or her family to do better. So I think that this market mechanism idea, this business model instead of a project model idea, it has to be taken away from some of the traditional business terms we think of it. Think of it more about who the customer ultimately is.
Yeah. So let's dive into some of the trends you describe in your book and some of the developments you basically see currently taking place within development. Social enterprises is one of them, having a more influence basically on the work we are doing. You also talk about the billionaire effect, basically the rise of new philanthropy, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, billionaires are one of the biggest influencing factors in this new era of development we're in. And it can be good, but there's also a lot of potential negatives. And so it's a big issue we need to really focus on. There are currently more than 2,000 billionaires in the world today in US dollar terms. That number is growing. We've seen a massive drive of inequality around the world, and the people at the very top, and it's even gotten exacerbated dramatically during this pandemic, are getting much, much wealthier. And the question is, what do you do about that? And in a lot of parts of the world, there are good debates happening about raising taxes, closing tax loopholes, addressing tax avoidance. But the level of wealth that we're talking about is so historically unprecedented that even with significant additional taxation, we're likely to still see many thousands of billionaires who have such a tremendous amount of wealth that could go to other things that could be good in the world. And so you had some efforts to deal with this. You've got the Giving Pledge. Now about 10% of the world's billionaires, a little more than 200 people, have signed up to that. That sounds like a good thing. It means you're going to give away half your wealth during your lifetime or upon your death. But I guess I would argue a couple of
things. So that's billionaires who signed the contract.
They sign it. It's not a legally binding contract. It's more like a pledge. Okay. And maybe that's part of the challenge, because not many of them have actually started significantly giving. They've signed this thing, they've announced that they want to do it, but many of them are not actually significantly giving their wealth.
So we know the Gates, we know the Fords. Who are these new billionaires? Who are these new philanthropies you're talking about?
Well, I'll tell the story, as I do in the book, of one that really is giving their wealth, and that's Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskowitz, a young couple in their 30s living in Silicon Valley. Dustin is famous for being a co-founder of Facebook, and he's also the co-founder of another company called Asana. They're a very wealthy couple. They have several, maybe 18 billion or something like that at this point. I haven't kept track, but it's a very significant amount, and they're giving it away, and they've given away more last year than the Rockefeller Foundation. And my guess, based on the growing size of their fortune, their commitment to give away basically all of their money, not just half, and their urgency in doing it, is they will probably be bigger than the Ford Foundation. So Rockefeller and Ford were the two iconic foundations of the last century, and they're going to likely be bigger, this young couple, on their own than both of them in just the next several years. And what's exciting about their approach is that they're using a very data-driven, lean approach to philanthropy. So they have a team, but it's pretty small. I think maybe 25 people or so. They publish everything very transparently about their decision-making, what they're giving to, and they kind of use it as a resource to other wealthy people who might want to give to say, here's some effective things you can give to. And they're driven by results and data in a very rigorous way. So they're an example, I think, of where some philanthropy can go. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of philanthropy that tends to be ego-driven, where it's about getting your name on a building, showing your legacy. And you know, the challenge there is that kind of giving tends to go to things like universities or, you know, arts and museums. And again, those are not unworthy causes, but
exactly,
there are people dying today of very basic preventable diseases. There are very simple things we can do to address much of this. And we know it works in a lot of cases, and we just don't see the level of philanthropy going into those things that that could. So this is an interesting moment because I think there's a global awakening around inequality. It's a driving force in conversations everywhere on the planet. And maybe there's a moment where we can shape the future of philanthropy and say, you know, people have to be held accountable. It's not just when a billionaire announces they're going to give away their wealth. We don't applaud that. We assume that. We applaud when they actually achieve something by giving the money to credible, reputable organizations doing evidence-based work in the places that have the greatest need. You know, this is the kind of ethos that I'm hoping we all can drive as a global development community.
Yeah. And I'm just very curious in terms of like the role of DAVEX in this, holding philanthropies accountable. Do you see any role for yourself in there?
I do. And I think there's a lot more for us to do. I don't think we've really achieved this yet, but I think there's a great opportunity in two sides. One is through the solutions journalism we do, to show billionaires who might be new to the philanthropy world that, look, there are things that we know work, that you don't have to go recreate the wheel. There's a tendency, especially in new wealth, people who have made their own money quickly in Silicon Valley or Wall Street or something, to think, well, I can solve problems. You know, let me look into this issue of global education. I'll just solve it. And that there's a lot of danger in that. And we've seen lots of failure in that. Whereas the better thing to do is to talk to the experts, look at the evidence, look at the data, and fund people who already do this work and do it well, especially at the local level. So I think we can help to shine lights on those things. Yeah. And then again, we can help to hold people accountable when their giving really doesn't meet those standards and best practices, or when they make big announcements but don't live up to them. Or maybe even those who just, you know, aren't doing enough. I do criticize quite a bit in the book, Jeff Bezos, who is the world's wealthiest man. And I think has done a bit more in philanthropy since my book came out, but not much. As a percentage of his wealth, it's a very low percentage. And he seems to be, again, doing some of the mistaken things of trying to recreate the wheel, start up his own initiatives, instead of just funding what works. And given his level of wealth and during this pandemic, there's much, much more he could be doing.
Yeah. And next to the growing philanthropy, there is also more investment from new countries in development aid, like Japan and India. Which was quite surprising for myself as well. What is the role of these new countries coming up and investing more in development aid?
Yeah, India's a good example. I mean, it's a big economy. It's a multi-trillion dollar economy now, and they've set up their own significant aid program working in the region. I think there's good things and bad things. So the good is more countries giving money means there's more aid available. There's more money potentially for multilateral institutions like the WHO. World Health Organization for multilateral initiatives, that's important. The downside risk is you see more and more countries, including my own, the United States, looking at their aid budget from a foreign policy lens. And they're using it to jockey for votes at the UN or for support for their markets and for their exports. And there's danger in that our aid really becomes like a short-term foreign policy tool. And we go back to the failures of the Cold War period.
Yeah.
And a lot of the critics of aid have good points to stand on, but usually a major failing in their analysis is they're looking at aid during the Cold War period and saying, look, a lot of this was wasted. And they're, of course, right, but it wasn't being used for long-term development. It was being used as a political tool. And unfortunately, I think we're heading back in that direction after a couple of decades of aid being more about kind of an evidence approach to what works. We may well get to a situation where countries are giving to their allies and giving to favored leaders and to support industries. So good news, there's more countries, many more. You mentioned India, Turkey, South Korea. These are all significant aid donors now that weren't a couple of decades ago. That's good, but aid is becoming more of a foreign policy weapon and less of a long-term development tool. And that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah. So basically there are all these philanthropies, but also countries who are investing more significantly in development aid. One of my biggest frustrations within development aid is the huge fragmentation, the fragmented landscape of all the different projects and the organizations. In that sense, it's not very sustainable. At the same time, you're saying the investment in aid is growing. We're moving from a billion industry to a trillion industry. So what is your take on the growing, perhaps growing amount of fragmentation even with this growing investments?
I don't see fragmentation in itself as a problem. Because if you think about it, your life as a consumer, you have so many choices. In a way, the commercial markets are highly fragmented in that sense. But it's okay because you're a consumer and you can make good choices. And if you decide to buy a product from one company and not from the other, maybe that company goes out of business. And eventually that can be okay because that can support, the best products and the best services for a growing economy. I think the challenge with fragmentation is when it's not in service of the customer, when it's not in service of the goal. Maybe the goal is ending poverty. Is the fragmentation that we see today supporting that goal or not? And one of the questions I ask in the book is, do we have the aid industry, the global development community, that is fit for purpose to achieve the sustainable development goals? And if not, how do we get that? I mean, that's something we should be doing, is aiming to reorganize. And it might be reducing fragmentation, but it's not about that for its own sake. It's about that for a goal. And so an example I give is Starbucks. We don't think twice if you walk into Starbucks and the coffee of the day is from Rwanda, or it's from Ethiopia, or it's from Guatemala. This is now completely normal. And these are countries where more than half the population lives in extreme poverty on under $1.90 a day, the World Bank's definition. So Starbucks is in some ways in our industry. They're a global development player because they have to source coffee from farmers, small-scale farmers, living at the very bottom of the pyramid. They have to make sure the coffee is really good quality, that it can survive in a global market in the Netherlands or in the US or elsewhere. They have to make sure there's sustainable water resources so they can count on the supply of coffee over time. They want to make sure there's no child labor, because customers like you and I won't go to Starbucks anymore if we find out they're using child labor. So they want to make sure there's enough money going to the farmers, they can send their kids to school. So suddenly they're in the development game in a way, right? Yeah. And that's the kind of fragmentation that can be positive, to say, hey, there's more players, but ultimately they're serving an end goal that is beneficial. So I think this market orientation, this customer orientation, not seeing that poor farmer as a victim, but seeing that person as a partner, a neighbor, a customer, a key player in the global economy, that orientation is what can drive us, even if there's fragmentation, toward the goals we want to achieve.
Yeah. So talking about the market orientation you were previously also talking about, I'm also curious for the role of private companies, also related to, for example, opportunities like social bonds, business partnerships, corporate social responsibility, moving towards together the sustainable development goals. Has there been an actual development in the past years of private sector meaningfully, not greenwashing, but actually meaningfully investing and working towards the sustainable development goals, do you think?
I think there have been. I really do. I think the problem is that it's still the minority of cases. When you go to a conference to talk about these issues, you usually see the same corporations showing up again and again. And some of them maybe are more talking about it than doing it, and some really are doing it. It's still, there are great examples. There's good reason for hope, but there's a long way to go yet. The reason I think there is a lot of hope, though, is that if we as consumers can live kind of a holistic approach in life and say, everything I buy should reflect my values. Everywhere I put my investment dollars into, my retirement account should reflect my values. And my work, where I go to work every day should reflect my values. If we can do that as people, and if especially the younger generation coming up, which really I think is pioneering this mindset, if they can do that, you can really change things in a much more significant way. Corporate social responsibility was essentially companies trying to show that they're doing some good things in the community. Yeah. And so they did that, but there's a limit to that. That's not their core business. So they'll give away some money, but ultimately they're trying to make a profit. They're not going to give it all away. But where you can get these companies to actually change the way they work, make sure their products are environmentally sustainable, that they don't use child labor, that they take care of their employees, that you know they respond to governance issues in the countries where they work or where they get their supplies from, there you can have much more significant outcomes. And I think we're seeing that. There are lots of good examples where that's happening.
Yeah. So we have been talking about the private sector, the role of social enterprises, philanthropies, new countries coming up, investing in development aid. What are any of the other trends you see?
I see a big trend that's related to seeing the poorest people in the world as customers and not just as beneficiaries. And that trend is around behavioral science. So, you know, one of the challenges in the old aid community, the old aid approach was to say, well, we can't really talk to our end customer. You know, we're talking about millions of poor farmers, let's say. So we'll design a program for them, but ultimately their voice wasn't very strong in the design of that program. And increasingly, there's more of a move to thinking of development problems, not just as economic problems, not just a lack of resources, where, well, we'll just give people a bed net, or we'll give them medicine, or we'll provide them books. What we've learned very clearly is that's important, but that's not enough. And we have to think of people even living in the most difficult situations, just like we would think of our own neighbors in an advanced, wealthy economy, as complex people with lots of influences, cultural influences, family influences, and we have to go and talk to them first and figure out what's driving their behavior. You know, I gave the example of a bed net. You know, I've had a chance as a kid a lot to sleep under a bed net, right, because of mosquitoes and malaria. Well, when you had that experience, you know, bed nets are not very comfortable to sleep under. And especially with little kids, they're a real pain. The kid wants to get up and go to the bathroom and you have to tuck the net and they get really hot at night. And so you can see why if you just handed out bed nets, you might get lots of people taking them, but not actually using them.
Yeah.
Whereas if you talk to people and try to find out, well, how can we make these more comfortable? Or how can we make this more practical? Or is there some training that we can provide along with it? You might get better results. And I think in our sector now, there's a much bigger and growing role for behavioral science, for human-centered design. And I think that's a very welcome change. And it's related to seeing people as our customers, as our partners, instead of just as someone who should be happy to get whatever handout we're giving them.
Yeah, I cannot agree more. I mean, being an interdisciplinary social scientist, I think it's very important to integrate an holistic approach to development aid. At the same time, also like in your words, the human-centered design movement is growing. We have already a lot of behavioral science experts. I think there is much more work to do, definitely, but there is also improvement going on in terms of how do you design programs? How do you design solutions? We need to have the people for whom we are working for in the lead, of course. So I'm very happy to hear also from your perspective that you're saying that human-centered design, for example, is one of the tools we have. Of course, we have a big toolbox, and I think this is one of the hopeful tools we need to work more on. Moving on from basically looking at all these trends and opportunities which are coming up, the paradigm shift, basically, right? Development aid is going through. I'm also curious about the what kind of influence this has on the current stakeholders of development aid. So we are going through changes, definitely, through some major changes. What is the influence of all these changes you have described on, let's say, you know, the usual suspects, the donors, the international NGOs, the implementers, and like me, development professionals?
I think there's all kinds of changes happening. I mean, one big change is I think there's going to be much more competition around results. So in the old days, you could publish, if you're a nonprofit, a glossy brochure, beautiful pictures, talk about your mission, show, you know, why we care. And that might have been actually enough. And of course, there would be some numbers in your report, but it might have been in the last couple of pages where you show your budget. And you know, you kind of say whether or not your organization is successful based on, did we have a bigger budget this year than last year? And still to this day, I meet, you know, CEOs of NGOs who will, I will say to them, how are things going with your NGO? And the first thing they say is, oh, our budget is up 5%. We've hired some more people, right? That's a lot of the mindset. And I think we're getting away from that to a more of a competition around who's got the best ideas and can show that they're working. Whether it's using evidence-based, you know, randomized controlled trials or other kinds of ways of assessing what works and what doesn't, calculations around cost effectiveness, return on investment. I think we're headed more in that direction, which creates more competition. So, you know, if you're an executive of an NGO, you have to be able to show how you're having a different level of impact and how and why someone should fund you and not your competitors. And if you're at a donor agency, there's even some competition coming there too, because sure, most donors are still government. That's where maybe half of the donor aid still comes from, or maybe a bit more. But you have some pressure to show to your population, to your legislatures, that you're actually spending the money well, that you're not wasting it. And as there's more data on what works and what doesn't, I think it creates more pressure to show that you're spending money in the right ways and the cost-effective ways. So I think competition is probably the biggest force that's going to affect all of us. And that includes aid workers, development professionals, who used to have a hard path getting into this career, but in some ways it's harder now, because really the most cost-effective investments are going to be hiring professionals in the countries where the work happens. And increasingly there are professionals, I mean, in almost all the places where we're working, who are from that society, who know the culture, know the language, understand the systems really well, and bring the technical skills. And of course, those are the people who make more sense to hire. So then if you're an aid worker or development professional coming from Europe or from the US or some other advanced economy, you've got to add a new level of expertise or a new niche skill set. You need to really bring something new to the table because it is a more competitive environment. So I think the aid industry is growing. There's more players, there's more money, more activity, but there's more competition at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the points you were talking about is also the local communities and looking at the current situation, the status quo. Basically inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement, there is also an increasingly louder call for decolonializing aid, like you briefly touched upon in the beginning of this podcast. Basically what I'm currently seeing around me, and it has been, of course, a discussion for many, many years, but it's growing, I can say. The movement is also growing. Basically the balance to change the power in development cooperation is getting louder and louder. Everybody seems to agree that it is time to invest more in local communities, local ownership, to drive the global development agenda. I'm curious, how can we create a new development aid where power is also devolved and development aid is actually led by local communities themselves? And perhaps an interesting mindset also to take into account is you're talking about competition being result-based, which can also be very much donor-driven at the same time. So how can we work towards a development aid, which is at the same time, perhaps in your eyes, also focused more on the consumer, at the same time having this market-based approach, but also actually and meaningfully being local-led?
It's a huge challenge. And what I hear mostly is people agree with it at a high abstract level. But when it comes to their own organization or their own work, they have a lot of reasons why it doesn't apply to them. This is a lot of what I hear. And when you talk to donors, you know, they would love someone else to fund this, right? They agree in principle, but that's not where they really want to put their money. And so I think it's a huge challenge because we're talking about building the infrastructure of our industry in a new way. And I don't think there's an easy answer. I don't think there's some easy solution here. These are systemic structural issues that go back, you know, to the colonial period. I mean, and that's why the term decolonizing development, I think, is useful and important, because it makes us realize how big of a deal this is. This is not something you can just do by, you know, making a small change, hiring a few more local professionals. I mean, that's not actually the level of change that I think people are demanding, rightly demanding, and that will get us to the kinds of results ultimately we all want to see. I think people who work in this field want to see. So I guess I would suggest just a few things is first, kind of taking a hard look at our own selves, our own work, our own organizations, and where you have objections, where it's easy to say, well, we can't localize for this reason, or we can't provide budget authority to our affiliate in that country for that reason. Stop yourself at those objection points and just see, is there anything we can do to get beyond this? You know, if I had to get beyond this, how would I get beyond that objection? And I think that can be a powerful internal organizing tool. And if we can just take some steps in that direction, we can start moving in the right way. I also think there's probably more room for some accountability here. So some more metrics-based accountability on which organizations are doing this well. And again, not just basic metrics like how many people work in your organization in a particular country, but let's look at boards. Let's look at executive suites. And are those reflective of the communities that we're trying to serve? And all of us, including us at DevEx, have a long way to go on all of these things. But I think we have to start asking ourselves those tough questions if we want to make any progress on something really big like decolonizing development. And then, you know, ultimately, there's a big move for more resources to come domestically in countries. And I think there's a lot of power in that, even if it's a relatively small percentage for some countries that are domestically mobilized. It does change the dynamic somewhat. And to work through governments, to work through local civil society, to get the legitimacy of our work through institutions in communities, I think that also helps to drive this localization and decolonizing development agenda. Because then they have a bigger voice. When we're working with the local government or the national government, or we're working with local civil society, their voice starts to matter more when we're depending on them. They might not bring as much budget to the table, but they're now a partner. They're not just a beneficiary. And if we can get them into that role of partner instead of just beneficiary, I think it does change the dynamic for all of us.
Yeah. So we all have a responsibility, you're saying, definitely. I cannot agree more. Also, in terms of the role of DevEx as being like an important influencer of development aid, also if you talk about journalism, right? What is the role of DevEx in decolonializing aid? And to what extent do you put emphasis on this very important and structural change we all need to go through?
So I think there's a big role for us to play because we see ourselves as an independent journalistic entity for the whole development community. And the whole development community, if you really think about it at that level, it's mostly professionals working in developing countries in their own country. But yet, so much of the voice and the authority and the budget is in places like Washington, D.C. and London. And we need to do kind of an extra effort on our part to make sure that the voices in the countries are reflected in our journalism. And I think you'll see some of that if you look closely at our work, but I hope you'll see more as time goes on. It's something we're focused on.
Let's agree on that. Thank you. Good point. Moving on, Raj. So like I briefly introduced in my introduction, you have been hosting many interviews during the pandemic with global leaders to shed a little bit more light on what influence COVID actually has on development aid and on our sector. Very interesting to watch. What are some of your key takeaways? Where are we heading to as a sector, actually, due to this COVID pandemic?
Yeah, we're at a real moment, a real inflection point, I think, as an aid community, as a development community. And we need to really think about what do we want this future to look like? Because we have a role in shaping it, even the narrative around it. So far, I think we've been shaping the narrative mostly in a defensive posture. You know, a lot of NGOs are losing funding. Their individual donors aren't giving as much, or their governments are shifting priorities. And so they see the kind of the headwinds, the challenges of raising funds. And so they're hunkering down. Some organizations are firing people, furloughing employees, they're closing projects. And so there's a sense of scarcity in our field. There's a sense of like shrinking resources. At the same time, there are some calls for more funding, especially around the pandemic itself. But I think this is a moment for us to really think bigger and to make much larger calls on our, especially on the advanced economies, on populations and on billionaire philanthropists and corporates to say, look, the inequality in the world, you know, when this pandemic started, there was an early sense that, well, maybe this was going to apply to everyone. It is a pandemic. It's facing every person. So in some ways, we feel more equal. It's kind of an equalizer. And on the other hand, it's quickly shown us that that's not the case, that actually the inequalities are magnified dramatically by this pandemic. And so the biggest issue in the world today really is that underlying inequality and the injustice that it creates. And I think we need a voice and a narrative as a community to say, look, that's not okay, that's not acceptable. And there is a big vision for how wealthy countries, governments, wealthy people, billionaires, consumers and employees in wealthy countries, investors, corporates, how we can all be called on to do something bigger. And I think in the absence of that, we'll just continue to face a challenge with growing populism, which might be more domestically oriented and less about a global community. And I think there's a real danger in that we could come out of this pandemic with inequality worsened and without a big vision for what to do about it.
Yeah, so hopefully we can take this shared responsibility and actually act upon it in order to make the world a little bit better after this COVID pandemic. Let's hope for the best. I think, we need to do it together. I agree. Raj, it has been a big pleasure to have you on the Disrupt Development podcast. Thank you very much for sharing your vision, also for sharing on how the global aid industry is actually currently transforming and what kind of responsibilities we all have together. Thank you very much and hope to see you soon.
I've really enjoyed the conversation, Alex, and I'm really pleased that you're focusing on these issues of disruption in our field. I think disruption can sometimes have a negative feeling, but we need to shake things up in our own field. And I think it's really positive that you're doing that. Thank you for the invitation to have this discussion with you today.
Thank you, Zoe.